So, good morning. My emphasis, hopefully, will be much more on what we have learned than what we have not learned, but I would like to end my talk with a few questions about what we have not yet learned. I feel very much a fish out of water at this conference, so sit back and relax and treat this as a cultural exchange. This is sort of a something. All right. The talk is something more of a colloquium-style talk, and it's a bunch of new slides in random order, so if it's a little rougher than usual, I apologize in advance. My outline, the last refuge of a scoundrel is always to go through the history of a topic when you're not quite sure how to start, and I'm going to do precisely that. I'm not going to talk at all about the pre-Rick murky history of experiments prior to Rick, which I really feel is a revolutionary machine in this field with its dedicated experiments and in particular its access to perturbative phenomena as a probe of a non-perturbative state of matter. Then I'll spend a great deal of time on Rick as a discovery machine, the properties of the thermal hadronic matter, the hydrodynamic behavior, and the precision obtained via those perturbative probes. And time remaining, I will emphasize ever so slightly what remains to be done. So let's really go back in history, and the first notable paper is this one by Fermi, in which he introduces the idea of using a statistical approach to treat the strong interaction. And this sentence, I think, describes very much his approach, and in fact we've come full circle around back to that, where the strong interaction, being as strong as possible, argues that one should in fact treat these systems statistically. And this is the paper, if you like, in which phase space, as particle physicists refer to it, was invented. The next notable event, if you will, in the field was this publication by Landau, and after paying due tribute to what he refers to as the ingenious approach of Fermi, then he proceeds to bash Fermi and refers to the defects of Fermi's theory and notes that he does not take into account the expansion of the system before what we would now call decoupling. And this paper is also notable for its emphasis on entropy and the isentropic nature of the expansion. This is circa 1955. Now, prehistory item three is something that's familiar to many people in the room, and in fact, it was a great surprise to me the first time I started giving a cultural talk several years ago when I Googled on Hagedorn to find all the recent work in it, but not the Hagedorn that I grew up knowing and loving, but the Hagedorn of string theory. But nonetheless, it's the same phenomena. A very rapid rise of levels, in this case hadronic levels, was noted in the early 70s. Here you see the rapid rise of those levels plotted as with their degeneracy this way, their mass that way. If you do a count of those levels, it is essentially an exponential increase, and if one fits that, one obtains some exponent here that would imply a limit. An exponential increase in the number of states implies a limiting temperature, and that limiting temperature is about 140 to 150 MeV, and it even implies, or that approach would imply, a latent heat as well. Now, there were puzzles with that approach. Here's a paper from Wong and Weinberg, 1970, in which they try and develop a consistent theory of the early universe in the context of this scenario prevalent at the time of an ultimate temperature. And they note that this has its own fine-tuning problems. You have to, in effect, assume that the universe is born arbitrarily very near the ultimate temperature, and one obtains very strange dynamics in such a scenario where the component that's dominating the mass density or the energy density of the universe has a strange history. So they took note of this, and of course all of this is precursors to what we know not from prehistory but from history, because history, of course, in 73 and 74, it became very clear that QCD was the correct theory of the strong interaction, and all of these other phenomena somehow faded from the view of some people, and people devoted a great deal of time exploring this wonderful new theory. Now, one can obtain a nice understanding of the Hagedorn temperature in the context of QCD, and this is very much a cartoon analysis, and one that I think ultimately has plagued us in our attempts to truly understand what's happening in a quark-gluon plasma. But nonetheless, one can take the pressure of, again, reasoning statistically, the pressure of a pure pion gas at temperature T, assuming those are the only hadronic degrees of freedom, and compare it to the pressure in a plasma phase where G is the number of degrees of freedom in a quark-gluon plasma. And that, of course, has to incorporate the fact that the overall plasma remains confined. So one who puts the bag constant in here, here is the corresponding number of degrees of freedom. Nature is always going to select the system. That's interesting. I love PowerPoint surprises. Nature is always going to select the system with higher pressure, and that doesn't, I'm sorry. I'll tell you what happened. Sometimes when you have a graph that is a nice picture and you close PowerPoint and you open it up again, it gets arbitrarily replaced with a previous graphic. So that's gone. I apologize. This little Maxwell construction would imply that one has a temperature of about 140 MeV with this latent heat, and this compares very well with the most sophisticated lattice calculations. And the fact that this toy cartoon compares well with the lattice, again, I think is a little bit misleading, but nonetheless gives us the right dimensional estimates for what we want to do. Pure Yang-Mills or what? Well, the lattice estimates I wrote there were with dynamical quarks. You're right. It's a crossover. Correct. If we continue on in our history, a really seminal paper or report, I should say, was this review. I put review in quotes by Edward Shuriak. It's a review because basically he was inventing much of this as he was writing it. If we open it up and have a look at it, you'll see that he coins a phrase that I've already used. He says, because of the apparent analogy with similar phenomena in atomic physics, we may call this phase of matter the QCD or quark-gluon plasma. So QGP, quark-gluon plasma. You'll see that in various places in the talk. Now, previous attempts have been successful to create quark-gluon plasma 10 to the 10th years ago. And here we see the sort of a standard plot from Kolben-Turner of the evolution of the number of relativistic degrees of freedom as a function of, well, not of time, but of temperature in the universe. And this very large cliff is the universe going through the QCD phase transition and the reduction, subsequent reduction in the number of degrees of freedom. Now, if this were, you know, old-fashioned technology, what I'd like to do is take this transparency and turn it over. I can't quite do that, but I can get close. So let's turn it over like that. All right, why do I want to do that? Because I'd like to focus now in this region right here and actually make a comparison to blow that region up and look at what people do on the lattice for various numbers of flavors. Here is effectively the energy divided by T to the fourth, or the number of degrees of freedom roughly divided by 3. And you see that regardless of whether one's looking at two flavors, 2 plus 1, in which the strange quarks become active, or all three flavors, one approaches, doesn't reach the Stefan Boltzmann limit as a function of temperature compared to the critical temperature thought to be of order 170 MeV. Now, there's an experimental history as well, which I alluded to in the beginning. And in fact, there is also a very interesting conference proceedings. This was convened by T.D. Lee, a workshop of BEV pernucleon, GEV pernucleon in current language, collisions of heavy ions, how and why. This is from 1974. QCD, I don't think, appears in there in any way, shape, or form. I won't swear to that. I haven't gone back and looked at it in that context. This was motivated more by the idea of Lee Wick states. But nonetheless, this motivated a very active experimental program beginning not long after 1974, and in my mind, culminating in Rick, and I'm not going to talk about these data whatsoever. So Rick is the machine at Brookhaven that's recently been commissioned, recently in the year 2000. These are its relevant parameters. The important thing is that it's capable of colliding essentially any nuclear species up to gold with any other nuclear species, and we have already taken advantage of that flexibility. If you run it as a proton-proton collider, its energy is 500 GeV. When you multiply by Z over A of the ions, that's your handle on it for the magnetic rigidity. The center of mass energy per nucleon-nucleon collision is 200 GeV top. Here are the relevant luminosities, which may not be too relevant to you. There are four experiments whose data I'll be reporting on, two smaller ones and two large ones, to give you some indication of the sort of multiplicity that each of these detects. I think the easiest thing to do, rather than you get some idea for the scale of the two large experiments relative to a human scale, but Brahms and Phobos measure relatively small, low multiplicity events in a small aperture, whereas Phoenix, a medium-sized aperture, Star, a very large aperture. I knew I was out of water in the very first talk of this conference when Professor Kuti referred to himself as an experimentalist, and I am indeed an experimentalist associated with the Phoenix experiment, and I'd like to give you an operational definition of a real experiment versus experiments that I've heard. It's a real experiment if and only if there's a substantial chance it can explode. And so at least three of these experiments satisfy that criteria. So that's what I mean when I talk about an experiment. Now, Rick's achievements to date, I'm not a big fan of exclamation points on transparencies or on slides. There'll be a couple, but these are kudos to the machine operators. It's really been a spectacular startup for a machine starting up. Never before has one tried to do heavy ion collisions in collider mode. It has exceeded by more than a factor of two its design luminosity. Along the way, it's also run polarized protons and polarized protons, so the first polarized hadron collider. The experiments are now in what I would call routine operation, and in fact, routine collection and analysis of data sets in excess of 100 terabytes per experiment. There are over 50 publications from the experiments in physical review letters. And as we'll see, there's excellent control of the systematics in the inter-experiment comparisons. The experimental results, record densities, 100 times normal nuclear density have been achieved. There's been the observation of clearly new phenomena, the so-called jet quenching, and very strong suggestions of a new state of matter. So the data to date that I alluded to, how could I try to summarize what they've measured in those first four Rick runs? Well, this is all that's been measured. And the corresponding set of antiparticles. So again, I won't reference my own experiment, but let's take my friends around the ring at Star. It's really spectacular that they are routinely, quote-unquote, measuring omegas and capital omegas and omega bars in these very complex heavy ion events, not to mention various resonance states as well. Now, how could one try to characterize this, what really is an embarrassment of riches? And I decided to provide you with a summary at not quite the beginning of the talk, but early in the talk. So the experiments work. That is a very non-trivial statement, given the complexity of the final state that they're observing. A very important point that typically when I give such talks, I take for granted, and I forget that this is not common knowledge, is that the initial nuclear geometry is determined by each of the experiments event by event. The impact parameter is well determined, as is the reaction plane. And together, that allows us to estimate the number of so-called participants and or binary nucleon-nucleon collisions. And much of the physics that I present will be presented in a specific particle production. Particle production per number of participants, or high PT particle production per number of collisions. That's by underlying nucleon-nucleon collisions. Now, something that is not common knowledge, or we haven't done a good job as a community as presenting to you, is that the multiplicities are, in fact, in some sense, low. I'll speak to that. The abundances are indeed thermal. The motion is hydrodynamic. New phenomena have been observed, the jet quenching and the baryon to pion anomaly being two of them. And there is evidence for a recombination mechanism at work at the partonic level. And if we allow ourselves to speculate a bit, there are indeed hints of the extraordinary. Now, let's spend a little bit of time on this idea of determining the nuclear geometry. Each of the experiments have a common set of detectors that they can use to reference their definition of centrality, the degree of overlap in the initial state, and in fact reference it between experiments in a very nice way. And the number of underlying binary nucleon-nucleon collisions then is determined as a function of impact parameter, as is simply the number of participants in the overlap region of a collision that's about to occur in this way. And this effort has been essential in making the QCD connection, since the soft physics, the low PT physics, goes typically proportional to the number of participants, while the hard physics goes as the number of underlying binary collisions. And another piece of jargon I'll often lapse into is we often express the impact parameter not in femtometers, but in terms of centrality, the 10% most central, the class of events that are the 10% most central. And one can map, for instance, 10 to 20% centrality back onto the number of participants in this way. You see that's something like 300 participants and about 700 binary nucleon-nucleon collisions. Now, as I alluded to, it's important to have this distinction between participants and collisions. If you think about some collision with some overlap that has strikes three nucleons in this nucleus with, say, five in that nucleus, how does one weight its contribution to the overall multiplicity in the event? Does one count it as 3 plus 5 or 3 times 5? People have had all sorts of violent arguments about that. And in part because the answer is a function of transverse momentum. If you're up here where cross sections are large, where shadowing plays a role, where you're doing soft physics, one refers to the number of participants as being the good indicator. If you're out here very far out in PT, where the cross sections are small, you're in perturbative physics, then the yield goes as 3 times 5, if you will, the number of collisions. And we're going to use that fact again and again in looking at the data. Now, what do I mean when I say the multiplicities are low? Here is one central event, actually very early in RIC history, taken from the STAR online event display, and most people looking at that one single event would hardly say that that corresponds to a low multiplicity. It's about 2,000 particles emerging from that collision in the central 2 units of rapidity. Well, they're low compared to the initial predictions, the pre-data predictions, the only good kind of prediction, of multiplicity based on what? Well, based on the increased role of hard phenomena expected at RIC due to its higher root S, and the subsequent parton cascading that would emerge that one would expect from mini jets cascading in this material. So here you see the rapidity density, dN/dy, as predicted by various theories prior to RIC, and compared to its measured value of about 600 charged particles per unit of rapidity. And you can say that most of the theory predictions were off by a factor of at least, 50% or so. The one that does very well, and in fact predicted something of order 600, the observed experimental value, was one based on the topic we heard about yesterday from Alex Kovner, the color glass condensate, which I will often write CGC, and that's one in which one takes into account the role of parton saturation. And in fact, as postdictions, it also gets the shape in phase space, the pseudorapidity density, extremely well. I won't go through the precise nature of this, but it was well covered yesterday, but I'll tell you an interesting connection. The argument simply is that the gluon distribution saturates in the initial state, at some value that goes as 1 over the coupling constant, and with a saturation scale going as 8⁻³, a collision puts those gluons on shell, and parton-hadron duality maps those gluons directly onto the observed particles, the charged hadrons. So if one plots not the number of particles, but the number per atomic mass, if you like, the specific particle production, then it should simply vary as 1 over the coupling constant, which would run if we could vary A, because this saturation scale goes as 8⁻³. Well, we haven't directly varied A, but again, we can vary the effective atomic mass by changing the overlap and studying it as a function of the number of participants. So here you see this specific particle production plotted versus the number of participants. And if one runs a logarithm going as this quantity through there, it describes that variation really rather nicely. And that was, to me, an unexpected connection that emerged very early and from the very first data obtained at RIC.
What is this yellow band?
This yellow band is the systematic error band associated with the Phoenix data. That's associated with the Phobos data. The Phoenix data is the black band. So, now, since then, we've done a more systematic comparison as a function of root S, going all the way down to 20 GeV, 130 GeV, 200 GeV. Here you see a broad variety of various models trying to understand the participant variation of this same quantity. Most of them fail rather spectacularly. And the only one that gets some approximation to the truth in all three root S's seems to be this parton saturation approach. So this is a very important question that is still under active study, and one of the things I would very much like to see is this parton saturation approach doesn't do terribly well at the transverse energy production, and that's something where it could and should be tested, and that work is underway. Now, the abundances are thermal, and that means that this can be a very simple slide, because if the abundances are indeed thermal, then the particle yields contain not a lot of information once I specify the temperature and the one chemical potential that's associated with this sort of matter. And if we assume we're in a Boltzmann limit, then of course abundances should scale in this way. And that means one ratio, say antiproton to proton, will determine the value of the chemical potential divided by the temperature. It just falls right out. You take that, you proceed then to predict all other yields. Well, you actually need something else to separate separately determine chemical potential and temperature, say a kaon to pion yield. Those two numbers then one compares to the abundances of this huge spectacular banquet of particles that have been measured at RIC, and one sees in all cases that the abundances of omega bars to omegas or antiprotons to pions are in very good agreement with this statistical model based on simple thermal physics. So it certainly makes sense to speak of this matter as being thermalized and having a temperature. Then I stated in my summary that the motion is hydrodynamic. Now, what does that mean? That's where, indeed, it's very important to have control of the impact parameter as measured in these events. One obtains a great deal of information not from the central events, but from the events that are very much non-central, where there is an asymmetry in the initial spatial geometry of the overlap region. And what has emerged is the ability to detect that initial spatial asymmetry, not via direct measurement of the spatial distribution, but via the emission pattern of the particles in momentum space. So if one measures in the full azimuth and detects particles as a function of the azimuthal angle around the collision axis and makes just a simple Fourier expansion, the first term for this sort of ellipsoidal geometry would be a cosine of 2 phi term. And this coefficient will appear on many slides, so please grab hold of that, of the so-called V2, the elliptic flow, as a function of the transverse momentum. If you look at the distribution, what one finds is that, yes, indeed, there is a modulation of the emission angle relative to the reaction plane really quite a strong, spectacular modulation. It's not a small effect. It's a 20% effect, plus 20 to minus 20%. And if one parameterizes then for each of these curves, you fit this V2 as a function of transverse momentum and compare it to what you would predict from hydrodynamic calculations, here you see that Fourier coefficient as a function of transverse momentum. It's different for different mass particles because it's a, if you like, a velocity-dependent effect, but we're plotting it versus momentum. And you can see really quite good agreement with hydrodynamic calculations for pions, kaons, and protons up to some transverse momenta of order 1.5 or so. So yes, it does appear that the expansion of this hot thermalized region does proceed in a fashion consistent with hydrodynamics. Now, what one would like to do is to probe not the final state of how this matter disassembles, but to obtain some sort of probe of the initial temperatures, the initial densities in this very dense phase, that it must be very dense. In fact, when one looks inside the hydrodynamic codes, one finds densities some of order 20 times normal nuclear density in order to drive this very strong expansion in this elliptic flow. Jets are a perturbative probe, and they would be ideal. They're certainly produced. We see them in proton-proton collisions at RIC. However, the traditional jet methodology used in particle physics of counting all of the energy within some cone will fail spectacularly at RIC because of the abundance of the soft particles that fill in that cone and wash out any jet structure below some very high transverse momentum. There's also a very strong interest in studying how a high PT parton emerges from this region, again, due to the non-abelian nature of QCD, where the energy loss per unit length is expected to be proportional to the path length, a direct consequence of the non-abelian nature of the medium. So much of the investigations I'm going to show you at large transverse momenta are really single particles serving as a surrogate for jets. And that's a well-developed technology that the leading particle carries a substantial fraction of the initial transverse momentum of the jet, and it works quite well. Now, RIC does indeed provide access to these perturbative phenomena. Here is a proton-proton, the pi zeros from proton-proton collisions compared to a standard factorization calculation, and you see really remarkably good agreement with a particular set of fragmentation functions over about 7 orders of magnitude. So we have these high PT probes well calibrated and under control, again, because RIC also functions as a proton-proton collider. They're measured in situ, and so our calibrations are well determined. One more bit of background, and that's to, again, provide some perspective for those who typically think of jets as 100 GeV objects as measured in D0 and CDF. Yes, indeed they are, but one should keep in mind that the single particle transverse momentum spectra already shows some sign of hardening, if you like, at a rather modest 2 GeV over C. That hardening increases as a function of root S. RIC is somewhere right in here. And if, in fact, I take some standard curve as a surrogate for that and look at where the deviations occur as a function of transverse momentum, indeed, from an exponential shape, it's at about 2. And when you look in the data, say at 4 GeV over C and proton-protons, you see nice back-to-back correlations in star for the final state particles. You can even go up a little lower in PT in Phoenix and see the same phenomena. So indeed, you see back-to-back scattering in proton-proton at these modest transverse momenta. I'm going to skip this other than as it's ancient data from 1975. This simply shows you that this idea of scaling hard processes, in this case deep and elastic scattering of muons, as a product of the nuclear, of the atomic mass in mu A scattering is very well calibrated. I don't particularly need to spend time on that because, again, we've done internal calibrations, if you like, with the RIC data of that. Now, this is somewhat an esoteric plot for a general audience, These are single electrons from non-photonic sources. What in the world does that mean? They're transverse momentum spectra measured in deuteron-gold collisions and then compared to a scale by the number of collisions from the proton-proton, fit to the proton-proton data. Single electrons from non-photonic sources are a very good stand-in for measuring open charm because they result from the semi-leptonic decay of d mesons once one subtracts all other so-called photonic sources, pi zero dalets, eta dalets, that create electrons. We know how to do that. Again, that's under control. And so one can look at how the charm, if you will, transverse momentum spectrum scales. It scales with the number of collisions in deuteron gold. It scales extremely well with the number of collisions for a variety of centralities in deuteron gold and in gold gold. So this gives us some idea that our N collision calibration, as determined in the initial overlap, is well calibrated. So here are all of those various scalings put together, and this so-called binary scaling seems to do very well for charm production in these collisions. If I divide it out as a function of the number of collisions, this is dividing by the yields divided by the number of collisions, it's indeed flat. So this seems to work. We actually can do even better than that because recently there are direct photons measured that again give us, well, ultimately we hope that the direct photons will allow us to determine directly the temperature in the initial state. But what they're doing right now is giving us a very nice way to calibrate this N collision scaling, again as a function of centrality. Here you see what the direct photon yield should be from perturbative QCD if the N collision scaling holds strictly and going through the photon yields extremely nicely. Here it is in an animation. And this is actually an honest animation. You'll see this bounce around in our peripheral events because that's actually a rather hard measurement. But as we go towards more central collisions, this perturbative calculation of the direct photon yield tracks the data extremely well. So that's the calibration. That's been done now. So I'm not following a historical order anymore because, in fact, this was discovered first before we had the calibration absolutely under control, but everything we did then has subsequently been validated. If one looks at the pi zero yields, remember I showed you that nice picture of the proton-proton pi zero yields and tracking perturbative QCD predictions. Here again, they follow in the non-central events, they follow the N collision scaled prediction extremely well. If I go over to a central event, this is the first example where we see actually a rather spectacular violation of this binary scaling, a prediction of the yield. Here is where the yield should be if that scaling held everywhere. Here is where it actually is in reality. Suppressions by factors, not some modest, 20% or 30% shadowing, but factors of order 5 out at the largest transverse momentum. Now, to systematize our expectations, what's good is actually to divide out the expectation, the N collision scaled yield, to divide the data by that. So that unity would be your baseline as a large transverse momentum. And again, this curve has a characteristic shape. Out here, we expect this N collision scaling to hold up at small transverse momentum. We're doing soft physics, and it's known to deviate from one. So this is what soft physics going to hard physics with no suppression effects would look like. What do the data look like? So let's take that the data I showed you. Combine it with this dividing by the expectations, and here's what one gets. So one sees that this suppression sets in at very low transverse momenta, extends out, bounces around a little, but certainly seems to be consistent with a straight line out to the highest measured transverse momenta as compared to what's seen in the peripheral collisions. Now, is this unique to the heavy ion events? Perhaps it's also there in the central deuteron-gold collisions. We felt that the results from our Deuteron Gold made the case so strongly that it was unique to gold-gold collisions, that is to say, to only in heavy ion collisions, that it was Brookhaven convened some press event. Here you see that here's those same data I showed you previously, the pi zero data, and these are from the four experiments, not quite pi zero data. I'll say more about that. What you see in every case is that the suppression is there in gold-gold, and that it's indeed an enhancement in deuteron-gold collisions. So it's not an initial state effect that's somehow there in the gold nucleus wave function, and we don't know how to count collisions. It really seems to be some final state suppression. So yeah, that even made the cover of Physical Review Letters. So here indeed you can see the utter difference between gold-gold and deuteron-gold. As you go to more central collisions, the yield goes down in gold-gold, it goes up in deuteron-gold. Could not be more distinct. Is it new? Here is that same ratio plotted for various energies. This is measured at CERN at lower energies, light ions, alpha and alphas at the ISR, RIC 130 GeV data, 200 GeV data, and it does indeed seem to be something that's happening at RIC that has not previously been seen. One would like to think that's precisely because at RIC one has clean control of perturbative phenomena due to the higher root S. Now, actually, that thing that looks like an exponential rise in the SPS data, we think is really an artifact of their not measuring the proton-proton reference in situ. Post-analysis might argue that it looks something more like that. That's a little more gratifying because the transition seems actually too sharp in going from low energies to higher energies. And indeed, this is a nice indicator of why it's so good to do those measurements in your own detector. This has generated, well, a lot of interest, but the interest was there from ancient times, if you will. There is this wonderful paper from Bjorkane, Energy Loss of Energetic Partons in Quark Gluon Plasma, Possible Extinction of High PT Jets in, that time, Hadron-Hadron Collisions. There's an entire cottage industry devoted to that, including our own Stan Brodsky. And where this has converged, I think, is the recognition that one must take into account explicitly the non-abelian nature of the medium. And in fact, this leads to the energy loss that's proportional to the path length in the matter, the so-called BDMPS effect. When one does sort of a state-of-the-art calculation of that form of energy loss in an expanding quark-gluon plasma and compares it to the gold-gold data and the deuteron-gold data, one gets really rather nice quantitative agreement, same parameters in gold-gold as in deuteron-gold. And from that, that allows us to infer the very high gluon density in the initial state and energy densities in excess of 100 times normal nuclear density. Now, one could ask how well calibrated this is, and perhaps plus or minus 50%. And there's where that's one of the things we should do better on, and will try to do better on. Now, one can apply this same methodology to a different meson, to ETAs. And ETAs show the pi zeros are in the open circles, the ETAs are the red circles here. They show identically the same suppression effect. And that is really interesting to me because that happens while they preserve the same eta to pi zero ratio you see in E plus E minus and proton-proton events. So that implies, if you see the same vacuum fragmentation ratio yields, that implies to me that the absorption is occurring at the partonic level. It's not, again, not some effect of the fragmentation function. Let's extend it to charged hadrons, and now one, in fact, does see a difference between the pi zeros shown in black, and here's the charge data for all the other for all experiments at RIC. And that's a little bit strange. I mean, aren't most of the charged hadrons in the final state pions? So you would think that they should be the same as the pi zeros. Well, the answer to that rhetorical question is, in fact, no. Other major discovery at RIC, another major discovery, I guess I should say, is that the baryon to pion ratio is drastically modified. So here you see the proton to pion ratio as a function of transverse momenta. And on here are E plus, E minus data, proton-proton data, the stars here at lower energy, and they agree very well with the peripheral gold-gold data. That's that red dash curve, proton to pions, antiprotons to pions. But as one goes to central events, this ratio changes dramatically. So what is going on there? And one way to understand this is as a competition between fragmentation and recombination. Now, recombination is actually a rather old idea. Here you see something from 1984 that the production of hadrons via fragmentation actually competes when you're in a thermal bath with recombination of lower momentum quarks. So, for instance, if I observe a hadron out here at 6 GeV over C, I could either fragment a quark from higher energy down to 6 GeV over C. If it's a meson, I could grab two quarks from 3 GeV over C and put them together. If it's a baryon, I can climb up even higher, and that's the source of the enhancement, and take three of them and put them together. Models that take that sort of approach are able to explain this proton to pion ratio qualitatively rather well. And the authors note explicitly that this requires a thermalized medium that you might as well call a quark gluon plasma. Now, if this is truly an effect of 3 versus 2, then it should depend. Here you see baryons not being suppressed, pions being suppressed. How do I know it's not really a mass effect? I know it's not a mass effect because I can look at the phi meson, and more or less seems to be in agreement with a meson suppression pattern rather than a baryon suppression pattern. But if I was selling you a Ginzu knife, I guess I would say, but wait, there's more. There's more because this Fourier coefficient, the anisotropy parameter, when one analyzes what that should do in such a recombination environment, this complicated pattern that is seen, actually then you rescale the transverse momenta for the number of valence quarks, the Fourier coefficient by the number of valence quarks, and that complicated pattern becomes universal. So that's very suggestive that this partonic recombination model is indeed applies. You can go on and extend this to almost anything else you choose to measure. It works better than it has a right to, and I mean that quite literally. So here's the current state of what we know, that the densities are high, there's strong evidence for thermalization, strong suppression, and indications of this recombination. So what don't we know? We actually don't know how to reconcile this recombination with the jet yields in a detailed quantitative way. It's a bit of a technical point. I won't go into it. But when one looks at the associated yields with jets, there shouldn't be any to zeroth order in a recombination model. There is. So why does that model work out to high transverse momenta? We don't quite know. What is the equation of state of the produced matter? We don't know that exactly by any means. Even more so, what is the state of the produced matter? Is it indeed deconfined? And is the flow truly non-dissipative, which you'll hear about in the next two talks? Here's this recombination. I'm going to skip that. State of the matter. At RIC, one does indeed see that the QGP equation of state, again for this Fourier coefficient as a function of transverse momenta, is preferred. It's the red lines as compared to the data versus the blue lines with a hadronic equation of state. But clearly, whatever equation of state was used in this calculation didn't get the proton yields correct. It missed them by factors of approaching 2. It just got the qualitatively right. We need to do a better job on that extraction. One can extend hydrodynamic calculations. Here's sort of the state of the art. And there's a strong interest in doing this in 3D using color glass condensate initial conditions. You can see that it doesn't work terribly well for the baryons. But one really wants, I have about 2 minutes, OK? One really wants to get a bound on the viscosity for reasons I'll tell you about. Here you see an attempt to do this. I'm sure Edward will tell you about this. The viscosity normalized by the entropy density. And one here again plots the Fourier coefficient. Here you see no viscosity. It almost kind of sort of goes through the data. It just happens to have the wrong curvature. And here you see something assuming this ratio is of order 0.1. Now, why is that interesting to do? It's interesting because of something that I would call, to borrow from Einstein, spooky connection at a distance. Okay? What does that mean? Well, we don't understand the differences between the Stefan-Boltzmann limit and what's seen on the lattice. That remains a bit of a mystery. There you see the difference for the three-flavor case. The success of this hydrodynamics requires that this viscosity to entropy ratio be very small. And both are predicted spookily at something as far removed from this field as one could possibly think, from essentially gravitational phenomena in the n equal 4 supersymmetric models. There's this value for the entropy, this value for the ratio of the energy density to the Stefan-Boltzmann. It's about 3/4 here. I really wish we knew whether this is 0.1 or 0.2 or 1. These sorts of calculations need to be improved. But we do know it's not 10 or 100. There's been a lot of talk about strongly coupled plasmas. I'm going to skip this slide. What this slide tells you is that I don't think we should have thought it was a surprise. I found three quotes in the literature spanning two decades telling us to expect precisely what we're seeing. Here is my personal perspective. If you look at the classical plasma physics coupling parameter, you do the most naive estimate. It should be about 1. You do a better one where you take into account the screening of the Coulomb potential. And I don't think we should be surprised that this material seems strongly coupled. It's an intrinsic property of the QCD plasma. And I like Edward's first name, the QCD plasma, better than the quark-gluon plasma, because people have come to believe the quark-gluon plasma as being some ideal gas. So my summary, all the words I said before, I think all of these things are clearly established in the RIC data. The hints of the extraordinary are the connections I referred to, and there's much more to come that's under active investigation. Thank you.
Okay, we have time now for one very urgent question, or two urgent short questions, because we will have later on a full discussion session. So, any questions? Stan wants. Stan dares.
You didn't talk much about the wayside jet suppression, which I thought is the most dramatic part of this.
I do have a slide somewhere on this. I mean, yes, this is a wonderful observation by the STAR collaboration. When one triggers in central events on a high PT hadron, and looks for its wayside partner, the thing you see so clearly in proton-proton collisions, it's not there. It vanishes as you go to more central collisions, implying total absorption or near total absorption of that high transverse momentum partner to the one that you see. So presumably you're seeing only the surface phenomena, and the other one is buried in the material.
I just want to make one comment. I always worry about the comparison with ISR and data, because it doesn't show 1 over pt to the 4th at fixed xt. It shows 1 over pt to the 8th for pions, 1 over pt to the 12th for protons. So the subprocesses that one sees at the ISR and Fermilab in that kinematic region, lower energy than yours, was really not 2-to-2 processes. I don't think it could possibly be. And as you compare down to the ISR and so on, I urge you to have data at different energies, you know, and really check the fact that the QCD processes are working right, particularly for the proton. It could really be that you're looking at higher twist processes, and there's a good reason for why they should dominate. They certainly do at the ISR, as far as I can tell.
I guess my response would be I accept your urging to look at lower energies, and I wish that the program committee that you sat on would have allowed us to do a lower energy proton-proton comparison run, which is badly needed for just that reason.
But maybe the answer,
one last question.
Maybe answer to your objection is that they do see recoil jet for deuteron. So there is something of this two by two kinematics. Yeah?
They're not. It's not. There's no difference on the recoil side. It's only on the trigger side that you. And so what happens? The recombination occurs in the subprocess, not after the fact. And then you have color transparencies. A lot of different things.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again and postpone the discussion till after lunch. Our next speaker is.